From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, two actors starring in fall films. Samuel Jackson co-stars in Quentin Tarantino's forthcoming film Pulp Fiction. He currently plays the father of a young drug dealer in Fresh. I spoke with him after his acclaimed performance as a crack addict in Spike Lee's Jungle Fever. In Quiz Show, John Turturro plays a Jewish contestant who goes along with the producers when they ask him to throw the game, and then he goes public about the fix. Turturro also worked with Spike Lee, like Samuel Jackson, in Do the Right Thing and Mo Better Blues. We also have a review of Quiz Show, and for the deprived baseball fan, a preview of the Ken Burns documentary series Baseball. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. A meeting has just ended at the White House among representatives of 24 nations that have pledged troops for the later stages of a possible Haiti invasion. President Clinton, Vice President Gore, and deposed Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide repeatedly thanked the group. Aristide also promised to promote reconciliation in Haiti, not vengeance and retaliation. He said he'd try to create jobs for members of the Haitian military. President Clinton told the gathering that no military action was risk-free, but he said the Pentagon has designed the operation to, in his words, maximize success and minimize risk to their soldiers. Troops from the coalition nations would go into Haiti as a stabilizing force only after U.S. forces remove the military rulers. France plans to send naval commandos to the Caribbean to evacuate French and other European citizens if military action in Haiti puts them in danger. But the government says it will not participate in an invasion of Haiti, a former French colony. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Military sources said France is sending a frigate and an 80-man commando unit to its island Martinique to stand by in case any Europeans need to be rescued from Haiti. The sources said the commando unit will coordinate with American forces, but will not take part in the expected invasion. Foreign Minister Alain Juppé said yesterday that France has too many other military commitments around the world. But the government has said France would send about 100 policemen to help the U.S.-led forces keep order after an invasion and to train local police troops. The support for the invasion is not backed by many human rights groups in France, who warn that the invasion could go all wrong. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin's hardline opponents nominated their presidential candidate today, but refused to reveal his name. NPR's Anne Garrels reports from Moscow.
A group of leading communists, nationalists, and arch-conservatives held a top-secret meeting today in Kaliningrad, a Russian region wedged between Lithuania and Poland. When they emerged, they would only say they'd selected a presidential candidate. While speculation is centered on ex-Vice President Alexander Rutskoy, the man who led the uprising against President Yeltsin last October, the group would not confirm this. The coalition, known as the Harmony for Russia movement, demands early presidential elections. They're currently scheduled for 1996. Today, Yeltsin's spokesman said the time was coming for Yeltsin to make a final decision whether or not to run. He suggested the Russian leader would take part. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
British Prime Minister John Major today ended a 6-year broadcasting ban on Sinn Féin, the political wing of the Irish Republican Army. The move comes 2 weeks after the IRA declared a ceasefire in its violent campaign against British rule in Northern Ireland. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 19.85 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. An explosion at a TRW airbag plant in Mesa, Arizona, has left two people critically injured. Five others were also hurt. The blast occurred in an area where chemicals are mixed, but there's no word yet on what caused the explosion. Owners of the Ford 2 Bronco will soon receive safety information telling them to avoid maneuvers that could cause the vehicle to roll over. Ford will distribute the information to settle a class action lawsuit. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The proposed settlement doesn't include any monetary damages. Instead, it calls on Ford to distribute safety information to hundreds of thousands of Bronco 2 owners. Ford will mail out special warning labels that fit on the sun visor of the vehicle, cautioning drivers to avoid sharp turns or abrupt maneuvers that could cause the Bronco 2 to roll over. The automaker will also supply owners with a videotape illustrating how the vehicle differs from a car. In addition, Ford will offer free safety inspections of the Bronco 2. The arrangement also allows plaintiffs to individually sue Ford for personal injury or wrongful death. The proposed settlement only covers Ford Bronco IIs built between 1983 and 1990. The Bronco II has been the subject of numerous lawsuits from drivers claiming the vehicles roll over during sharp turns. Ford has maintained the vehicles are safe. It says it agreed to the settlement because it thought it was fair, even though no jury has ever found the vehicle to be defective. Courts in Louisiana and Alabama will have to approve the agreement between Ford and attorneys for the owners. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Vietnam's foreign minister will come to Washington next month to meet with Secretary of State Warren Christopher and members of Congress. The announcement came after 2 days of high-level meetings between American and Vietnamese negotiators in Hanoi. Both sides reported progress in resolving the cases of missing American soldiers and on establishing diplomatic offices in each other's capitals. The foreign minister also said he'll meet with U.S. trade organizations while in Washington. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition of our show, we feature actor Samuel Jackson. He co-stars in what may be the most anticipated film of the fall season, Pulp Fiction, directed by Quentin Tarantino. Jackson is now co-starring in Fresh as a chess hustler whose son is a drug dealer. I spoke with Jackson in 1991 after he played a crack addict in Spike Lee's Jungle Fever. The judges of that year's Cannes Film Festival liked Jackson's performance so much they gave him a special award for Best Supporting Actor. In Jungle Fever, Jackson's character Gator is driven by his addiction. The only relationship he has left with his family is pleading for money, which he knows they don't want to give him. Here he is trying to wear down his architect brother Flipper, played by Wesley Snipes, and his parents, played by Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee.
Oh, look at here. I'm a little light, though.
Yep. What, you didn't get your check from Soul Train yet?
You know, Don lost my address. Come on, hit me. Get some cash in my hand.
Gator does his dance when he asks anyone in his family for money. I asked Samuel Jackson the story behind this dance.
Well, actually, it's written in the script. That was Spike's idea, but I had to make up the dances. I assume, or I judge by the way that I used to do things at my house, when my mom had her friends over, they would always call me in to do the new dances for them. And there would be older ladies sitting there watching you do the twist or the jerk or something.
Right.
Talking about how that would ruin their back if they did it.
That's right.
And it was a form of acceptance and performance that always garnered you praise and sometimes, you know, monetary recompense of some sort. You know, the ladies would give you quarters, dimes, whatever. And I'm sure that his mother did that very same thing. And they danced together. And he used the same tactics to entertain Flipper, played by Wesley Snipes, when he was younger, too, to placate him and to get things out of him. So he uses that. It seems to be something he knows that works, and that's what he uses.
Do you know people who are crack addicted, or have you run into a lot of people
Yes.
on the street who are?
Yes, I have, and I do, and I did. All of those. I knew people who were addicted, I know people who are addicted, and I know people who are in recovery, and all of that. And in talking to them and talking to drug counselors, I discovered that using drugs usually cuts off your emotional growth. So I stopped Gator's emotional growth at about 16. So that when he reacts to things, he reacts to things as a 16-year-old. He wants what he wants when he wants it, kind of like a baby. And in doing that, it leads to a certain amount of vulnerability and not having a lot of coping skills in the world. So he reverts to that dance and begging rather than his own wiles.
Did your part in Jungle Fever give you a new understanding for our empathy with addicts?
Well, I always had that. I had a roommate who was a heroin addict in college. I've always had friends who were involved in drug trade or in an addicted state. Even in my early, my formative years, I knew those people because I lived in a neighborhood in Tennessee that was kind of an alcoholic neighborhood. So it was the drug of the day was alcohol at that period. And we had a neighborhood drunk. There were lots of people in my neighborhood who sold bootleg liquor. So I saw people who were drunk all the time. That was another kind of addiction. And I had friends who drank from an early age throughout school. And then I knew people who did pills when it was time to do pills. And I guess during the 60s, I did all the things that all the people of my generation did during the 60s. So I had my own drug experiences at that time with marijuana and all the other things that passed through that era. And you just outgrow them. I did, but some people don't.
Do you think that there's a difference between your portrayal of Gator the crack addict in Jungle Fever and how you'd be expected to play that role or what you'd think of playing that role if it was in, say, a crime series on TV or a big budget action film? Do you know what I mean? Where you wouldn't be the main character, you'd just be like a sidebar character who's like the crack addict.
Well, you only get a chance to see addictive behavior in those kinds of films. I had a chance in this film to take Gator out of the stereotypical addict role, where you either see him nodding or being totally crazy. So you had a chance to get into Gator the person, Gator the human being, and not just Gator the junkie, someone you don't care about at all or have no feelings about one way or another. Most of the time, those characters pass through films and they're props more than anything else. And since Spike was accused of not addressing the drug issue in any of his other films, I guess he attacked it with a vengeance this time and made sure that there were things going on.
Have you had to play more generic kind of roles in TV or in movies? You know,
Yeah. Well, I've been cast as Black Man in Sea of Love. That was my name. No, it was Black Guy in Sea of Love. That was the character name.
Is that what it said in the credits?
That's what it says in the credits, Black Guy. So I guess you could say I have. But I always try to make those characters memorable. People always remember me from the things that I do. It's back to my friends calling me King of the Cameos. I pass through films and kind of leave my impression. They always remember me.
Now, didn't you spend a couple of years on TV as Bill Cosby's stand-in?
Not on TV, actually.
That's right.
I got to do
the set.
Yeah, on the set. We had a whole stand-in family, and we would go in and... Actually, we did. We were the junior Huxtables, I guess. And we would watch them rehearse the show, write down the blocking, which is the way they move around the set. And on Wednesdays in the mornings, we would go in and actually do the whole show the way they did it so that they could plot out their camera shots and camera moves. And I wore Bill's clothes over my clothes because he's larger than I am so that the lights would be correct and they could get their color palette down. And I did that for 2.5 years, actually, and never got on the show. Well, actually, I did. Every time they show an exterior shot of people walking down the street outside their house, that's me and this other girl who was a stand-in, and we walked past each other. That's the only time I was ever on that show.
So as the stand-in for Cosby, you must have spent a lot of time sitting on the couch making jokes and being wise.
Yeah.
That's kind of how he spends the show.
Yeah. I imitated him quite well, so I did that for a while. And it was fun. It was kind of like taking a how to act on TV course for free and being paid at the same time.
So did this lead to any breaks? Did anybody offer to help you from the series?
Help me do what?
Get an on-camera gig.
No, that was always the thing that was kind of dangled to us to keep us coming back to do that job. You know, there's always a possibility you'll get on the show. I never worried about that, really. I was just there to do that while I wasn't doing anything else. And when it was time for me to do other things, I just went on and did them. I didn't wait for my big break on the Cosby Show because I really didn't realistically think that was going to happen, and it didn't. And I don't know anybody who's done that job who's ever actually gotten on the show. And I know people who've been there for a while, and I know people who've moved on and done other things who never got on there either. So it's kind of like the same thing. Actors always get stuff like that. People ask you to do off-Broadway shows and tell you, well, you know, they're actually thinking about moving this show. You know, everybody says that. So you take your chances. I don't particularly believe anything until I sign a contract. I learned that early in the game. I sign a contract, I believe anything you say. Until then, it's all speculation.
We're featuring a 1991 interview with actor Samuel Jackson. He co-stars in Fresh and the forthcoming Pulp Fiction. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with actor Samuel Jackson.
Now, in Spike Lee's movie School Days, you mm-hmm. played a townie who was really hostile to the students
right.
who had arrived from out of town.
Leeds. He had a name. Leeds, L-E-E-D-S.
Thank you.
Yes.
But you yourself were not a townie. You were a college student and went to...
Did you say colored or college? What did you say?
College.
Oh, okay.
You were a college student.
I'm just kidding.
Oh.
All right.
Yeah, you were a colored student.
Yes.
Yeah. No,
okay, but back to your question. Yeah. Yes, I was not a townie. No, I was not a townie. Yes, I went to Morehouse.
No, but yes.
Spike cast me in that role specifically because for a long time, my freshman year in college, this was before Spike's time, but I think Bill Nunn told him about it, the fellow who played Radio Raheem.
Yeah.
Well, Billy's a good friend of mine. But my freshman year at Morehouse, I actually hung out with the Block Boys. That was what we called them, not townies, but Block Boys. I actually hung out with them, and they didn't know that I went to college for about 6 months.
Oh, were you hiding that from them?
Not really, but I used to be with them when they were robbing college students and beating them up. And so they didn't really know I was one of them until they saw me at a dance one night and I had on some Morehouse gear or something. They're like, you go to Slim, you actually go to college? I was like, yeah. And it kind of changed their image of the Morehouse guys, and they didn't beat them up so often.
Oh, so you were really performing the role of Good Samaritan here.
That wasn't my purpose. Actually, what happened was when I got to college, my mom dropped me off there and I saw a basketball court up the street, and I played basketball a lot then. And I went up to the basketball court, and I bought a quart of beer. And I asked who was up next, and I played with them. And they just assumed that I had moved in the neighborhood because I was there every day and a long time, most of the day. And they just assumed I was one of them. And I hung out with them like I was.
So what kinds of things would they say about the college students?
Well, they were stuck up. They were what they called sadiddy. They actually thought, well, a lot of them did think they were better than, and we were taught that we were better than also by the administration of the school. We were told that we were in the top 10% of the Black race who was going to lead everybody out of darkness into the light, and that Morehouse men were, at that time, something like 75% of all the doctors in America were Morehouse men, and the Morehouse men were publishers, editors. They were the leaders of the race. So a lot of them really believed that, and they didn't speak to them. The guys would just say hello, and they wouldn't speak back. And that would be cause for a beating or another attitude to flare up, or they would run them back to campus, mainly because they wouldn't speak. They ignored those people who lived in the community like they invaded these people's community and felt that they were there to run it. And that wasn't the truth.
Were you ever in the position where you were with your friends and they were robbing a college student who you happened to know?
Yeah.
So what happened?
Nothing. He looked at me, and before he could say anything, somebody hit him. And by that time, they took his stuff, and we left. And as a result of that, I ended up in the dean's office because the guy did recognize me, and he did report the robbery and did say that I was with him. And as a consequence of that, I was put on probation a few times because I refused to identify the people who did it.
Right. Did it ever bother you that they were doing that?
No.
Why not?
Because they were... Actually, well, 90% of the time, they were correct, and the person that they were taking the stuff from could afford to have it taken. And they were people with petty bourgeois ideas who needed a lesson like that in reality.
Speaking of petty bourgeois,
mm-hmm.
Now I understand that when you were in college, that you were one of the people who held some of the trustees hostage.
Yeah.
So what were the issues?
The issues were that there weren't any student representatives on the trustee board. There weren't any community representatives because we were right in the middle of this community and these people should have a say in what kinds of things go on around them. There weren't enough Black faculty members. We wanted more Black studies because there weren't any at the school. We were trying to change some of the policies. And Charles Merrill, who was the head of the trustee board at that time, told him we were absolutely correct. But it was these, quote-unquote, men who were trying to make us these perfect Negroes who thought we were upsetting their apple cart. And they told us that we were the kinds of people that they never should have let in Morehouse in the first place. We were more or less an experiment and the kinds of people that they let in when my class came in. And we turned out to be just what they thought.
So did your radical politics go along with a radical sense of theater at the time?
Yeah. Well, no, I wasn't even doing theater then.
Oh.
Actually, I was just a student.
So you can't call this guerrilla theater then?
Well, that didn't happen until I came back to school in 71, second semester of 71. And that's when I started my theater major in earnest. And aside from the Morehouse Spelman Players, which was our proper theater in school where we did all our school productions, we had our own theater company, the Black Image Theater Company. That was our Hate Whitey Revolutionary Theater. Where we did all those kinds of revolutionary poems and skits about the supremacists. We had like a singing group that was like the Supremes, but we were called the Supremacists. And we sang racist tunes. And we did all those Die Nigger poems so black folk can take over, you know, New Nation poems. And people were paying us to do that stuff. We were traveling all over. We were going to Tulane and Florida State and all kinds of big white schools. And they were like, yes, yes, denigrate us, yes, do it. And we enjoyed it. It was great fun.
What led you out of the radical period, the radical theater period?
What led me out of it? I didn't have time to do it anymore. And then times changed. People became very apathetic. Mm-hmm. Everybody was out trying to make a buck, and nobody was real concerned. I mean, Black Power just died for some reason. I don't know what it was. I guess it was oversaturation or whatever. But when people stopped wearing afros and wearing dashikis and nationalism didn't become so fashionable, then that theater changed into more or less of a mainstream type of thing. The Black Image Theater started to do scripted plays that were still about, by, for, and about black people, but it wasn't that, you know, Die Whitey or Hate Whitey theater. It was more about the black human condition.
This may sound like an odd question, but this summer has been like a terrific summer for young black directors and mm-hmm. actors.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, you know, that so many of these new directors are really pretty young, and a lot of the actors who they're casting are pretty young, too. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you think that there'll be room for actors who are, gosh, already in their 40s. You know what I mean?
Like me?
Yeah, right, in the newer movies. You know, it's like, it's really great, but
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. This will give me a chance to do the kinds of things that I've never been able to do. By being able to work with these younger directors, I'll be able to play a father who has a father's sensibilities, because I am a father. And I'll be able to play somebody's mentor, possibly, because I haven't been able to do that. So I think I'll be able to work with these kids. And I think that my work will speak for itself, and that if they really want a good actor to do something, then they'll ask me to do some of those things that 40-year-old people do in their films. They won't all be so teen-oriented that I won't be able to do anything. I'll be the teacher at the school, the principal, whatever. Who knows, you know? I'll do something.
Well, Sam Jackson, I wish you the best. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Samuel Jackson, recorded in 1991. He co-stars in Fresh and in Quentin Tarantino's forthcoming film Pulp Fiction, which is scheduled to open next month. Next week, Pulp Fiction will be the opening night film at the New York Film Festival. There's no more Major League Baseball this season, but there is Baseball, the new 18-and-a-half-hour documentary series by Ken Burns, producer of the PBS miniseries The Civil War. It starts this Sunday and is presented over the next 2 weeks in 9 episodes, or innings. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
The biggest complaint I've heard about baseball is that it's too long. But that's like saying NYPD Blue has too many characters, or The Simpsons takes on too many targets, or Seinfeld makes too much about nothing. All I know is my best measure of whether a TV show is really outstanding is whether it stops me from doing anything else. And baseball stopped me in my tracks. It demands that you look and that you listen, and it rewards you for the effort. Producers Burns and Lynn Novick and principal writers Burns and Jeffrey C. Ward have done really great work here. And just as the Civil War miniseries showcased the knowledge and enthusiasm of Shelby Foote, Baseball does it with dozens of contributors, from baseball players to paleontologists, from comedians to politicians. You can hear the emotion in their voices as they talk about the sport, or a particular player, or even a specific game. And you can hear it right now. Here's Mario Cuomo, who almost made the majors, on the symbolism of baseball.
It is a community activity. You need all nine people helping one another. I love bunt plays. I love the idea of the bunt. I love the idea of the sacrifice. Even the word is good. Giving yourself up for the good of the whole. That's Jeremiah. That's thousands of years of wisdom. You find your own good in the good of the whole. You find your own individual fulfillment in the success of the community. That the Bible tried to do that and didn't teach you. Baseball did.
Here's Billy Crystal describing a recent meeting with baseball great Ted Williams and revealing how vivid both of their memories were about a game played in the sunshine long ago.
I walked up to him and I said, I had a picture and he signed it to me and all that stuff. And I said, Ted, I have home movies of you striking out against Bobby Shantz, 1957, Yankee Stadium, second game of a doubleheader. He says to me, curveball, low and away.
And here's Buck O'Neill, who's bound to emerge from baseball as big a star as Shelby Foote did from the Civil War. O'Neill listened to games from outside the ballpark when he was a kid. He played and managed in the old Negro Leagues and was the first African-American coach in Major League Baseball. He's 82 years old now, but listen to him talk about baseball, and he seems about 60 years younger. Here he is pairing Babe Ruth to players who have come after him.
I heard Ruth hit the ball. I'd never heard that sound before. And I was outside the fence, but it was a sound of the bat that I had never heard before in my life. That was Ruth hitting the ball. And the next time I heard that sound, I'm in Washington, D.C. I rushed out, and there was Josh Gibson hitting the ball. And I heard this sound again. Now, I didn't hear it anymore. I'm in Kansas City, and I heard this sound one more time that I hadn't heard only twice in my life. Now, you know who this is? Bo Jackson swinging at that, and now I heard this sound. It was a thrill for me. I said, here it is again. I heard it again. I've only heard it three times in my life, but now I'm living because I'm going to hear it again one day if I live long enough.
John Chancellor's narration is perfect. The images and sounds and music are woven together as beautifully and thoughtfully as they were on the Civil War, and, well, you get the idea. Baseball is not too long. Baseball strikes are too long. And you don't have to love baseball the sport to love baseball the TV series. You don't even have to love TV. You just have to love quality.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back, 'cause it's root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame, 'cause it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game. Katie Casey saw all the games, knew all the players by their first names, told the umpire he was wrong all along, and she was strong.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on this archive edition, an interview with actor John Turturro. In the new film Quiz Show, he plays the contestant who blows the whistle on the producers after they get him to throw the game. Quiz Show is directed by Robert Redford. Turturro has also been directed by Martin Scorsese, the Coen brothers, and Spike Lee.
Then critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of Quiz Show. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Defense Secretary William Perry has told CNN that negotiations are still underway with the Haitian military on a way for them to give up power. And at a Washington news briefing today, White House advisor William Gray said it's still possible for the Haitian rulers to avoid a full-fledged invasion.
My sense is that if the coup leaders, General Cedras Biambi and Francois, step down, that will avoid it. That is what the president said last night, they know what that message means. And I think it is very clear that it is imminent, that the multinational force will be coming to Haiti.
White House advisor William Gray. Delegates from 24 nations that will contribute troops to the later stages of a possible Haiti invasion met today at the White House. President Clinton thanked the group and promised the operation would be short. He said no military venture is without danger, but that the Pentagon would maximize success and minimize risk to the contributing nation's soldiers. While the meeting was going on, several D.C. fire trucks pulled into the White House driveway. A White House staff member had smelled smoke and called the fire department just to be sure. NPR's Mara Liasson was there.
Complete pandemonium broke out at the White House, but it turns out that there was no disaster after all. The president and deposed Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was in the East Room conducting an event with all of the leaders of the Caribbean countries and the other nations who are going to participate in the invasion force to Haiti. All of a sudden, fire trucks arrived at the White House. The entire press corps rushed out to the driveway outside the West Wing, but there was never any threat of fire. There was no evacuation. The situation is now completely under control, but obviously this is a week that started with a plane crash, and it's ended with at least a fire department visit.
A short in a light fixture apparently caused the smoke. In Arizona, 7 people have been injured, 2 critically, in an explosion at an airbag plant near Phoenix. From member station KJZZ, Laura Carlson has more.
The explosion occurred early this morning in an area of the TRW plant where chemicals are mixed. Mesa Fire Department Captain Cliff Puckett says that portion of the airbag manufacturing plant was being renovated.
They were in the process of upgrading their equipment. They had removed equipment from a room. We're in the process of putting upgraded equipment in, and that's when the explosion occurred.
Initial reports from the scene indicated that one person had died, but Fire Captain Puckett says that victim is on life support and another is in extremely critical condition. Workers in the immediate vicinity of the blast were evacuated, but employees were allowed to remain elsewhere in the plant. The cause of the explosion has not been determined. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Carlson in Phoenix.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials fell more than 20 points today. This is National Public Radio News. A federal jury has ordered the Exxon Corporation to pay $5 billion in punitive damages to Alaska natives, property owners, and other people hurt by the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. The jury also ordered the tanker's captain, Joseph Hazelwood, to pay $5,000. Exxon lawyers have indicated they'll appeal the verdict. The U.S. official in charge of negotiating with North Korea over its nuclear program has rejected Pyongyang's latest demand. Assistant Secretary of State Robert Gallucci says North Korea has no right to dictate which type of nuclear reactor it will take in exchange for existing reactors that can make nuclear weapons more easily. The BBC's Charles Scanlon has more from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
Mr. Gallucci said the question of replacing North Korea's existing nuclear program had become a key element in the dispute with Pyongyang. The disagreement is over the role of the South Koreans. Mr. Gallucci said South Korea must play a central part in supplying the new technology, and he forcefully rejected the latest demand from North Korea, known as the DPRK, that it choose the model.
It is ludicrous on the face for the DPRK to suggest that they will decide the architecture and the United States will pay.
Mr. Gallucci said the United States had no intention of improving its relations with North Korea at the expense of the South. He said there was now no daylight between the positions of Washington, Seoul, and Tokyo on how to proceed next in the nuclear dispute.
Charles Scanlon reporting. Apple Computer has decided to make its Macintosh computer compatible with other systems. Until now, Apple's policy has been to keep the Macintosh system separate from computers run with MS-DOS software. That approach is believed to have badly hurt Macintosh sales, since users couldn't coordinate between different types of computers. Some economists predict the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates again after today's industrial production report. The Fed said output by the nation's factories jumped 0.7% in August. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Turturro made his screen debut in Raging Bull. You wouldn't remember him from that. He had only one line. Now when Turturro is in a film, he has a big part, and you notice him. In the new film, Quiz Show, he plays the Jewish contestant who blows the whistle on the producers after they get him to throw the game. He's been in three Spike Lee films. In Do the Right Thing, he played the racist son of the pizzeria owner. The Coen brothers wrote parts for him in two films, including the leading role in Barton Fink. I spoke with Turturro last year after he co-wrote, directed, and starred in the film Mac, an homage to his father, a first-generation Italian-American who was a carpenter with a contracting business in Queens, New York. In the film, John Turturro played the part based on his father. The father comes across as a pretty pushy guy, so I asked Turturro if he was ever embarrassed by his father.
I'll tell you a quick story. My father saw a film, To Live and Die in L.A., that I was in.
Yeah.
And I took him to see the premiere. And he, when I was running in the scene through the airport and Bill Peterson was running after me, my father shouted out to the screen in front of all these celebrities, "Go, John, go! You know, they can't catch John." Andy Warhol was there, all these people, like totally having the time of his life. And I was hitting him. I was telling him, "Dad, be quiet." He looked at me like I was crazy. And, you know, in retrospect, he was right. That was the proper response to a film like that. He was the perfect audience for it, and he was having a good time. So, you know, he wasn't intimidated by all these, like, pretentious people around him. I remember when he met Andy Warhol afterwards, he didn't know who he was. And right in his presence, he said, "Who's the guy with the white hair?"
Well, that must have made you feel real good at the time.
Well, I was embarrassed, but later on, you know, you really think about, well, why was I embarrassed and stuff like that.
In Miller's Crossing, you played a bookie, Bernie the Schmata Birnbaum.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great scene in which the character played by Gabriel Byrne is taking you into the woods to execute you. And you're basically begging for your life. And you're kind of, you know, whining and begging. And it's really, it's a fantastic scene. Would you describe that scene for us and tell us, like, what you came prepared to do, like how you prepared for that?
Well, I can't describe what I did because I really don't know what I did. I'll tell you the truth. You know, after you do all your preparation, you throw it away. I've had a couple situations where people have, you know, by accident pulled out. Once I had someone pull out a gun on me when I was a young kid, and I remembered that. But I never had that situation exactly happen to me. But I've seen weapons, and I know that it can be a very scary thing. I just tried to put myself in the situation and use everything within my means to survive and believe in that situation as best I could. And I didn't monitor myself at all. It's actually a little strange to watch because it's very well put together and scored and everything also. That's why it's so effective. But it's, you know, you would hope to reveal something. I like to be able to do that if I can. And I think I did in that scene a little bit. But I can't explain to you that I was thinking exact. I do all my work and then I try to just, I hope it's there.
Tommy, you can't do this. You don't bump guys. You're not like those animals back there. It's not right, Tom. They can't make us do this. It's the wrong situation. They can't make us different people than we are. We're not muscle, Tom. I never killed anybody. I used a little information for a chisel, that's all. It's my nature, Tom. I can't help it. Somebody hits me an angle, I play it. I don't deserve to die for that. Do you think I do? I'm just a grifter, huh, Tom? I'm a nobody. But I'll tell you what, I never crossed a friend, huh, Tom? I never killed anybody, never crossed a friend. No, you all bet. We're not like those animals. This is not us. This is a half dream. It's a dream, Tommy. I'm praying to you. I can't die. I can't die. Out here in the wood. Like a dumb animal. In the wood, like a dumb animal. Like a dumb animal. I can't die out here in the woods. Like a dumb animal. I can't die.
In an earlier movie, Five Corners, in which you played a kind of psycho type of guy who kidnaps a character played by Jodie Foster, you threw your mother in that movie out the window.
Right, but I didn't write that. John Patrick Shanley right. wrote that.
Now, so did you have to explain that to your mother? Mom, I did not write this movie?
Yeah, well, my mother was, I remember seeing it with my mother and father. It was the last film my father saw me in. He was quite ill, and my mother was just, you know, flipped out when she saw it. And my father, like, thought it was really funny. So my mother was crying and my father was laughing. He couldn't believe how bad I was. And I, you know, that was a great scene, writing-wise, I think, because John tapped into a very simple thing. A parent and a child, and the parent has never listened to the child. And the child is desperately wanting to be heard. And once the child is heard, then, of course, he took a dramatic liberty and said, okay, well, let's end this relationship on a good note, you know. But that's why that scene was powerful. You know, people talk about the end result. That was a great scene.
You've made several movies with Spike Lee.
Mm-hmm.
In Do the Right Thing, you played the racist son of the owner of the pizzeria.
Yes.
Did you have your choice of which son you got to play?
Yes. Yes. And I chose to play the racist because I am a racist.
Oh, I knew that.
and Spike knew that. And no, he had asked me what I wanted, you know, interested in. And he wanted Richard Edson to play a role. And I had read it, and I just thought that the more interesting part was the guy who was, he said, you know, maybe you want to go against, you would probably play this, the part I wound up playing. Maybe you want to play the other part. And we looked at it and stuff, but I thought that was the more important role in that film. And he certainly was expressing a lot of sentiments that were important to the film. And I thought I could make him human. And that's what I tried to do.
In most of your movies, you've played either Italian or Jewish characters.
I've played other characters. I have.
Right. But well, most of them have.
Some
no?
that you Some. Know of.
Okay. Some.
right. yes. I've played heavy characters, too, on stage.
right, right.
Yes.
You have what might be described as ethnic features, facially?
I'm dark.
Mm-hmm.
I have dark hair. I have a prominent nose. And I am from another country, and they came to here. But I'm as American as a lot of other people.
Does your do you feel that you have been held back from certain leading man type roles because you don't have like the perfect Hollywood type of version of handsome?
Well, you know, you can look at it both ways. I'm sure there are guys who are gorgeous who wish they could do some of the roles that I do. Do you know what I mean? So
mm-hmm.
No one's totally an actor. Is blessed and burdened with their face and their body. I think I am a versatile actor. I certainly played a huge gamut on stage, from Greek to Spanish to Italian to Jewish to English. And I think I can do that in the films. I may not play a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant because I probably won't be cast that way, but I certainly can play a lead, you know, the lead in a film or a small role in a film. The thing is, there are many stories to tell. If a person, you take the Jewish experience, there are millions of stories to tell, or the black experience. Just because a guy's a black actor doesn't mean he can't play someone articulate, someone who's ignorant, you know, someone who's ambitious. There are many different stories to tell. Unfortunately, in films, they usually tell the same story when it comes to certain ethnic groups over and over and over again. And if you are from an ethnic background, or a minority, you realize that from the scripts that are offered to you. I've tried to do intelligent scripts and ones that would be entertaining too.
Mm-hmm.
And that wouldn't be an insult to the people that I know.
We're featuring an interview from last year with John Turturro. He's now starring in Quiz Show. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actor John Turturro. You grew up in Queens. What got you interested in acting when you were young?
Well, when you don't have a lot of money, you know, you see a film like The Sea Wolf with Edward G. Robinson or something with Burt Lancaster, and, you know, you travel. You go somewhere. And that was a means of escape. And my whole family were film lovers. We all watched films and became very involved in them. And I, you know, from James Cagney, you know, to Kirk Douglas, to Marlon Brando, and they had a big impression on me. And I loved athletics also. Maybe if I would have been a better athlete, that would have been something I would have loved to do also.
When you were young, you used to keep a scrapbook of your favorite actors?
Yeah, yeah. I had ratings, reviews. I was ahead of Siskel and Ebert. I told it to Roger Ebert. I said, your show, when I first saw it, was like, you know, my kitchen table. We used to discuss films like that all the time and have big arguments and say, you know, Burt is a much better actor than Kirk, or Kirk is better than Burt in this film. And, you know, well, what about Anthony Quinn? Oh, you know. So, yeah, I would rate all the actors and review it. And, well, actually, I had an injury one year, and that made me sort of, I watched tons and tons of films. I broke my leg severely, and I did a lot of my scrapbooks then.
So, you grew up in New York City. Did you watch Million Dollar Movie, which had continuous showings of the same film all week?
Loved Million Dollar Movie. It was a study guide, basically, for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because the film, if you liked it, you could watch it five times.
Right. Now, the films I saw the most in Million Dollar Movie included The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Fantastic.
Fantastic.
Charles Laughton, one of my favorites.
Yeah. King Kong and Mighty Joe Young.
All right. You're right up there. Right up there. These are all, you know, Five Corners was a homage, in a sense, to King Kong. I mean, yes. You know,
you think
Shantley.
So?
Oh, yes. I was basically playing the human version of King Kong. John Shantley, I'll tell you that, with a little bit of Frankenstein thrown in.
Oh, that's great.
Mighty Joe Young.
That's
You're talking
great.
About, you know, things close to my heart. Close to my heart.
So when you were really getting involved with watching movies on television, keeping your scrapbook, did you try to act around the house? Did you do impressions?
I used to do impressions, yes. And I did it with my cousin Ralph, who did all the paintings in the movie and the storyboards for me. We used to do a little act together. But yeah, I used to do lots of impressions.
Of who?
Bert, Kirk, Marlon, Rod Steiger. You know, matter of fact, one time we performed at a club, and instead of doing, like, you know, just funny sort of skits with humor, we started doing, like, serious scenes from On the Waterfront. Someone threw a bottle at us. It was in high school. And I was so shaken up. I was like, come on, you know, I was like, what are you doing? Yeah. But it was a way of, like, you know, it was your first impulse towards acting.
Uh-huh.
So, oh, yeah.
So what was the Burt Lancaster scenes that you would do?
Oh, you know, from, you know, you name it, Brute Force, Elma Gantry, Jim Thorpe. Jim Thorpe, that was a big one.
And Kirk Douglas?
Kirk Douglas, you know, Spartacus was big. But all his movies, Champion. You know, Kirk, he's my, you know, he was like one of my men. And Burt is like, well, that's why Burt's in the film. You know, Burt was like... You know, he had to be in the film, basically. Because Bert was like an extended member of our family. We would talk about Bert as if he was like an uncle, you know. Because we loved Bert. You know, my father loved him.
So can you still do impressions of these guys?
I can still do Bert, that's right.
Would you?
Would I do Bert? I was just, you know. You have to give me some lines. Well, from Sydney, Sydney, you're a cookie full of arsenic. I'd hate to take a bite out of you.
Oh, that's great.
Well, you have to see me do the whole with the hands and everything.
No, that's from the movie where they're a gossip columnist.
Oh,
What's it called?
Sweet Smell of Success.
Yeah, Clifford Odette's screenplay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sydney,
yeah.
You live in moral twilight. Yeah, I love him. He's fantastic.
So who would do Tony Curtis to your...
Tony Curtis? You know, Tony was a big one, too.
So your friend
sometimes
would
my
do
cousin
Tony?
Ralph would do it, but my brother Nicholas would do it. You know, my little, you know, we would all, you know, I was obsessed with those guys. I mean, obsessed with them.
Have you met them?
I've never met Bert or Kirk. Those two guys. I worked with Anthony Quinn.
That's right.
That was a real thrill.
In Jungle Fever.
It was very, very nice. You know, I mean, we're him. he was really, he was great. You know, it was a thrill to work with him. It was, he told me stories about everyone. He's been in this business for 50 years. And he still is so enthusiastic and eager, and he really likes what he does. Those guys had big, you know, Cagney, Edward G., you know, and Charles Laughton, too.
Charles Laughton said my very favorite quote about acting, which is, people don't know what they're like, but I think I can show them.
Wow. That's well said. Really well said. Whew. Wow. I'm going to write that down. Thank you, Tara.
Hey, anytime.
Thank you very much. I'm going to put that right in my journal. Yeah, that's a good one.
John Turturro recorded last year. You can see him in the new film, Quiz Show. This is Fresh Air. It looks like an invasion of Haiti is imminent. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have about Haiti on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have the latest news of U.S. diplomatic efforts to try to coax Haiti's military rulers out of Port-au-Prince. We'll also be hearing some experts on Latin America talking about the whole idea of building democracy by restoring President Aristide to Haiti, whether that's really possible or what can be done that might assist Haitians toward democracy. Our reporter Michael Sullivan tells us what's happening in Port-au-Prince today, and Richard Haass, formerly of the Bush administration, gives his view of this imminent American-U.S. military intervention.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new movie Quiz Show, directed by Robert Redford, is based on a real scandal. In 1958, a former contestant revealed that the TV game show 21 was rigged. Winning players were being supplied with answers to questions asked them on the show. The film is based on a memoir by Richard Goodwin, a congressional investigator who exposed the scandal. Critic Evan Whitehead says Quiz Show is a good film, but not a great one.
Robert Redford says the quiz show scandals of the 1950s marked the end of a period of innocence in our social history. Well, yes, but of course we Americans are always losing our innocence. Think of 1963, 1968, Watergate, Vietnam, the Challenger disaster, the cancellation of the World Series. To lose our innocence over and over, we have to be a little oblivious, have to be the mark who's eager for the con. That's a big part of what Redford's quiz show is about. It's not that TV's corruption was exposed, but that exposure didn't make much difference in the long run. When crooked contestant and upper-class charmer Charlie Van Doren finally confesses to a congressional committee, the senators compliment him on his fearless honesty. The best thing about this elaborate period piece and morality play is the fine sense of social distinction and class antagonism screenwriter Paul Attanasio brings out. At the bottom of the social heap is John Turturro's Herb Stempel, a Jewish guy from Queens who's riding high on TV's quiz show 21 until he's swept aside when Van Doren shows up. Somewhere above Herb is Harvard-educated Jew Dick Goodwin, the dogged congressional investigator played by a cigar-chomping Rob Morrow. He talks like some lost Kennedy brother raised down by the bus terminal. Goodwin's class resentments are fueled by his low government pay. Above him is college prof Charlie Van Doren, a Connecticut WASP played by Rafe Fiennes of Schindler's List. Charlie's smooth and ingratiating, but he has no trouble keeping Goodwin in his place, even as the investigator closes in.
What is this? It's still that business with Stempel. Dad says he's not the most reliable fellow.
Well, there's a problem, Charlie. I found another contestant, a man named James Snodgrass, and he says he got the answers, too.
You sure these people are telling the truth?
He put all the questions in a sealed envelope and sent them to himself, registered mail. That was 2 days before he appeared on the show.
Doesn't prove anything.
Hey, you don't have to be a genius to connect the dots.
Well, don't connect them through me.
Hey, don't treat me like I'm some member of your damn fan club. Are you telling me everybody got the answers but you?
You're so persistent, Dick. You know, I really envy that.
Was it just the money, Charlie?
You'll forgive me, but anyone who thinks money is ever just money couldn't have much of it.
Quiz Show does make you feel for Charlie. It makes the temptations of fame and money palpable. But he's a little less classy than his father, the poet Mark Van Doren, played by Paul Scofield, who has Thomas Merton over to the house for a birthday party. Unlike some exposés of large-scale corruption, Quiz Show names real names, including 21's network, NBC, and the show's sponsor, Geritol. But in other ways, the movie romanticizes the scandal. Visually, the 1950s decor seems closer to the 1870s of Scorsese's Age of Innocence than to our time, especially when we visit the Van Doren's New England estate. By the way, Scorsese himself does one of his entertaining on-camera turns as Geritol's shifty frontman. Some unconscious class distinctions may creep in, too. Turturro's whining Herb Stempel comes off as less sympathetic than his WASP rival, especially since Van Doren is played by a classy British actor. If Redford seems a little too impressed by money, rich as he is, that does give Quiz Show one curious mark of distinction. Too many Hollywood movies are homages to innocence made by cynics. You might look at Quiz Show as an exposé of cynicism made by an innocent.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz and film critic living in Brooklyn. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mary Madeline and James Carville met, fell in love, and then more or less went to war on opposite sides of the battle for the 1992 presidential campaign. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Madeline and Carville. They collaborated on a campaign memoir called All's Fair. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.